So, imagine this. You are a resident of London in the reign of Henry VII. You wake up one morning, you prepare yourself for the day ahead, doing the tasks you need to make a living in this busy metropolis. And suddenly you hear, or maybe even see, an army appearing just beyond the city. Angry men, intent on mayhem, intent on rebellion. And you, and your city, is right in the crosshairs. The sudden attack by thousands of Cornish rebels on London was a moment which is often forgotten about. Even today, only a few memorials exist about this overlooked little attack. But I think it's worth examining. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to look at that, plus to finish off a few stories that have been going on in the background throughout the story of London over the last few episodes. Hi there, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, the podcast that tries to tell the history of the city as a chronological narrative, carefully following the story of this metropolis in detail and slowing down to enjoy the view and get into how what was going on there in some detail. We have reached the last years of the 15th century and find ourselves dealing not just with this sudden attack upon London by the residents of Cornwall, but also the events regarding the last few years of Perkin Warbeck and more. Welcome then to chapter 180 of This Story of London, Cornwall Attacks. So, how the hell did we get here? In the spring of 1497, Cornwall, that westernmost county of England, was suddenly gripped by rebellion. The reason? Tax. King Henry VII needed to raise money in order to pay for a large army to go north and kick the snot out of the Scots who had just invaded England. The result of this sudden crisis is that Parliament awarded the king around £120,000 in order to do so. Allow me to stress, this is a staggering amount of tax at the time. So you can understand just how staggering it is. In most years, the parliamentary grant to the king was roughly about £31,000 a year. The previous largest grant ever given to Henry VII had been in 1492, and that had been to fund a massive invasion of France, and that just been over £53,000. The massive tax burden affected almost all the population, a population who, unless they happened to live near the border, could see no overwhelming threat from Scotland, let's be honest. And for the West Country especially, as far away from Scotland as you could imagine, they saw no threat at all from Scotland. But keep in mind, the West Country had also provided a regular supply of soldiers and men for Henry VII's armed forces. The problem was, this tax was really badly timed. And while the tax was a spark, no fire can ignite without fuel. And in the years previously, Henry VII had been, dumping flammable materials all over Cornwall. The cause of his problems was simple. Henry VII was working under the assumption that Cornwall was heavily loyalist towards him. Back when he'd been in exile in Brittany, several Cornish nobles and prominent figures had been supportive of him. So supportive that actually when he went to invade England, he did briefly consider maybe he should invade Cornwall as a better option over the eventual target of his invasion, Wales. After 1485, then, Henry VII showed great favour to certain Cornish gentry, and he designated his son and heir, Prince Arthur, as the Duke of Cornwall, all signs to show the Cornish people that they existed in his grace and favour. However, several of these local gentlemen who Henry VII supported were linked to various misdeeds around the county, and above all, in 1496, Henry VII's regime got into a series of arguments with the local workforce about the regulations of the tin mining industry. Now, we know, not suspect, but know, that Henry VII was not a fine detail kind of ruler. As we saw with his problematic dealings with the merchant adventurers of London, what Henry VII liked to do was go, "I have a great idea," and implement this great idea. But then the experts in this thing that he had a great idea about would go, "Ah, Your Majesty, there's a small problem with your great idea because of this thing. Oh, and that thing, and the implications of this other thing," and they'd hit him with small details, which mean his great idea wouldn't work. And then typically Henry VII would get a tad frustrated and stop the thing and basically went, "Well, if you don't want it my way, you can't do it." And while that description is a little bit simplistic, and I'll take that on board, when it comes to the issues of trade with Flanders and also the issue of tin mining industry in Cornwall, it basically does apply. Negotiations failed with Cornwall due to the technical issues of his new regulations, and so Henry responded by suspending the privileges of the stannaries. And the stannaries is the name given to the four tin-making authorities in Cornwall who regulated and ran the extraction of tin from the mines in the region. So basically, no stannaries, no tin mining. No tin mining, and the entire Cornish economy suffers. And the whole region becomes tense and broke and angry. And then a year later in 1497, the authorities present the Cornish with the biggest tax bill anyone can remember. Boom. Local people were incensed and angry, and way out far to the west of Cornwall, in the parish of St. Keverney, the son of one of the four men who'd actually been sent to raise taxes from the locals, a lawyer from Bodmin called Thomas Flamank, started encouraging the locals to do something about it. And very quickly, other places nearby began to join in. Flamank did what most rebel leaders did. He told the angry Cornish that the king was not to blame. Oh no, not our God-given king. He was anointed by God. There is no way anybody would be angry at him. No. The problem, according to him, was the king's, quote, evil advisers, unquote, Cardinal Morton and Sir Reginald Bray. They were responsible for all the issues. And maybe we should just go march and let the king know that we, his loyal subjects, were suffering. And so, driven by desperation and a righteous fury, the Cornish began to march. As they did, their leadership seemed to have coalesced around Flamank and a blacksmith who came from down in the region we now call the Lizard, a man called Michael Joseph Angoff. The march grew in size. Local clergy and well-established Cornish gentry joined them. The march was, on the whole, orderly. They got to Devon. Here the locals remained mostly aloof to the march. This is probably because Devon and Cornwall didn't always get on in this era. But when they reached Somerset, several prominent Somerset gentry and clergy aided the rebels, judging by the royal fines issued afterwards. A local tax collector was supposedly killed. First blood was drawn. When they reached the town of Wells, they gained the support of Lord Audley, an impoverished and rather discontented noble, whom, says one source, they, quote, with acclamation, accepted as their chief, unquote. And thus, with a new military leader, they marched east, across England. They met with little or no resistance as they marched. No doubt, many sympathised with their protest, and, you know, based on the fines we see after the rebellion, it does suggest that along the way, many people did join them as this tax was crippling. This was becoming the most frightening variety of rebellion for a Tudor monarch. A cry of anger which crossed social barriers and went beyond its original region. This was no longer a West Country thing. It could become a national thing. Added to this, Henry VII was caught totally by surprise by this. It came out of nowhere. By June 13th, 1497, this mob of West Countrymen and their allies was now said to number a massive 15,000 souls, and they had just arrived at Guildford. That's a huge force, and it was aiming directly, it seemed, towards London. The king had an army of 8,000 men that was being prepared to march north against the Scots under the command of Lord Daubeny. This was now rapidly diverted south while the king went about raising as many men as possible. By the 13th, Daubeny's armed force made camp on some wild ground to the southwest of London, Hounslow Heath, and there waited for the Cornish to attack. The next day, as the Cornish continued to move forward, there was fighting. It wasn't much, it was a bit of a skirmish. 500 of Daubeny's spearmen and an unknown number of the rebels clashed near Guildford. This skirmish was, however, the first armed opposition the rebels had met since the whole thing started, and it clearly indicated to the leaders of the Cornish rebels that a heavily armed force stood just in front of them, and it was between them and London. It was said that the lawyer Flamanc was the one who advised them to skirt south of the city and aim for Kent. Ah, Kent. The birthplace of Jack Cade's rebellion, the birthplace of the peasants' revolt, the place where all knew if anywhere was going to support a rebellion against unfair taxes, it would be there. His suggestion was accepted, and the vast Cornish force then changed direction a little, marching east, first to Banstead, and then up to Blackheath. The high ground with a commanding view of the city of London, the place where Wat Tyler, John Bull and Jack Cade had all called their headquarters at one time or another. The plan was to get there, await reinforcements from Kent, and thus by June 16th, they were setting up their tents there. Now, Henry VII had been gathering forces up in Henley, and by June 16th, he was able to bring his new forces to combine with the army he already had out there under Daubeny. Meanwhile, in London, well, as you can imagine, the city woke up on the 13th of June to the news that an army of 15,000 men, twice the size of the nearest royal army, was marching towards them with evil intent in mind, and responded as you can well imagine. How London responded is interesting, and it is a tad confusing. The few eyewitness accounts have some occasional contradictory information in them, and also we have to understand the wording of some of these documents and the age and decay of some of the documents make easy interpretation not always possible. But I will try and reconstruct as best I can what we can glean from the pages. Now, the mayor that year is listed in the Chronicle of London as Johannes Tate. He was a member of the Mercer's Company, who had made it to the top of the political heap by becoming mayor. When news reached him that the Cornish rebellion was just south of the city in a huge force, he actually responded with the determination the contemporary mayors of the city demanded. This was a Mercer mayor of London, like their eminent predecessor, Geoffrey Boleyn. London, under him, would show their strength. This was a city who had faced down Jack Cade and the Bastard of Falkenberg. So, if the Cornish want a bit of London, come and have a go if you think you're hard enough, sweetheart. The city mobilised, and the red and white striped members of the London garrison were armed and made ready. The bridge was enforced, the gates were manned. Come on then. The Chronicle of London, written at the time, tells us that members of the royal family were in London when this crisis erupted. Quote, and the king went from Shane the Monday the next following, and the queen, with my lord of York, came upon Tuesday to Cold Harbour, and there lay till Monday following. And from whence his grace, my said lord of York, at the age of 6 years or thereabouts, removed unto the Tower of London, unquote. So while the crisis was erupting, the queen and the spare, Prince Henry, first fled to safety within the city walls and to the mansion of Cold Harbour, where the Queen had been based immediately after the Battle of Bosworth, before she sent on the young Henry to the extra protection of the Tower of London. However, the Queen and him were still staying in London. This sent out a signal to the city's residents. The royal family was with them. Indeed, Grafton's account of this hints at this. Quote, when the nobles of the realm heard of this tumultuous business and commotion, they came to London, every man with as many men of war as they could put in readiness, to aid the king if need should be. Unquote. The London Chronicle then says, quote, and the Thursday following was a general wasty in London. And the same afternoon, my Lord Chamberlain, with other knights, accompanied by horsemen, came unto Hounslow Heath, whether they're sent by the mayor certain carts with wine and vitali, unquote. So here we see London is actively looking after itself and firmly aligned to the king on this matter. The hastily armed men of the city were now on General Wercary or Weshy. This is a wonderful Middle English word that we no longer use, and it means wakefulness or vigil or sleeplessness. In short, London was on 24-hour alert, with men on duty day and night. London did not sleep during this crisis, but vigilantly kept watch, and when the King's army set up down on Hounslow Heath, it's, as it just said, they sent food and drink to those troops, London's way of showing the love. It is worth noting that after the skirmish down by Guildford and the Cornishmen moving on, the London records say that, quote, "At night, after 10 of the clock, the host of the Lord Chamberlain came into St. George's Field, and there lay the knight," unquote. So the Royal Army shadowed the Cornishmen, keeping themselves between the rebels and London. St. George's Field is roughly where Newington is today, so they overnighted there, keeping an eye on the road to London Bridge and protecting London. Apparently during the night, quote, "with secret means made into my Lord Chamberlain by divers of the Cornishmen, and it would please his lordship to, in the mean unto the King's grace, that the said commons of Cornwall might have for them a general pardon. They would of a surety bring into my said Lord Chamberlain the said Lord Audley and the other head captains, the Smith," unquote. So here was a claim that during the night some of the Cornish rebels were already willing to defect and hand over their leaders. We do know the next morning De Bourny's force left St. George's Field, travelled south to Croydon, but then returned to reoccupy that territory as the rebels were moving towards Blackheath. Behind them, when this was going on, London was ready, and we read that while this was happening, quote, "and when the mayor with his brethren and all the chief crafts of the city were ready standing in harness from the bridge unto Greathchurch to receive the king, which as the mayor had understanding that his grace that night would have cometh to the tower, tidings came to the mayor that the king entered that night to lie at Lambeth, so that every man departed home, and the king was afterwards seen in the field, and a brewing and a comforting of his people," unquote. So yes, here we see London defiant. The mayor and his brethren, aka the aldermen, and all the chief crafts of the city, which means the livery companies, standing in harness. So basically armed to the teeth and wearing what armour they can and in resplendent uniform. They were ready and on standby because the idea was that the king was coming to London, to the Tower of London. The mayor was ready to join him, but as we read, he actually probably got as far as Westminster, then crossed the river and spent the night near his forces in St. George's Field in Lambeth Palace before joining him in the morning. Henry VII was still a warrior king, and this is where he should be. The sight of him joining the forces was comforting to his people. But while the accounts say that the Londoners stood down, it's highly more likely, especially based on stuff said later, that several of the London host assembled south of the river to join forces with the king's already existing forces. On that day, however, quote, "the Cornishmen came unto Blackheath, and there pitched their field, and there lay all that night in great agony and variance. For some of them were mended to have come to the king, and put them fully in his mercy and grace," unquote. So it turns out that the news from Kent for them was bad. Not only were the people of Kent not willing to rebel against the king and this tax and join the Cornishmen, a large force of Kentish lords were marshalling their forces to stand against them. These Cornishmen then lost heart as they found the leaders were preparing for battle. Guns apparently were placed to defend the passage of the river at Deptford. According to what we see, apparently during the night, a large number did desert, and only about 10,000 were left to face the Royal Army, now said to number an overwhelming 25,000. King Henry VII not only concentrated overwhelming forces against this rebellion, but he planned his attack meticulously, sending a force of archers and cavalry round the back of the rebels. It has to be understood, a decade earlier, Henry VII had only just defeated Lambert Simnel at the Battle of Stoke after a stiff 3-hour contest. This time he wanted a quick and crushing victory. The fighting started, but didn't entirely go all his own way. Lord De Bourny had gained Dartford Bridge, but was then taken prisoner. Luckily, he was released almost at once. But then the battle was fairly one-sided. And a later brutal account of what follows says that ultimately, quote, "the Cornishmen, being ill-armed and ill-led and without horse or artillery, were with no great difficulty cut to pieces and put to flight, unquote. The massive royal army cut down the Cornish rebels and the rest soon surrendered. The king had won an actual battle at London's doorstep, and it was now time for him to receive his adulation. Quote, at about 4 o'clock at afternoon, he came over London Bridge, where at St. Magnus Church, the mayor with his brethren in scarlet received him, to whom he gave cheerful thanks for his good diligence upon keeping and ordering of the city, and also for the plenteous vitallying of his host, after which thanksgiving, in the same place, the king, with his own cert, which was good about him, he dubbed the mayor knight, John Shar, one of the sheriffs, knight, and the recorder, Robert Sheffield, unquote. So yes, in Magnus Martyr's church, he gave knighthoods to the mayor, the sheriff, and the recorder for their duty and their logistical support, them wearing the scarlet or the red and white of London. Keep in mind the sheriff at that point, John Shar. We'll mention him in a future chapter. And after he'd rewarded the Londoners, quote, from thence rode into Polis and there offered, unquote. Yep, the London folk has ceremony done. The king in triumph attended St. Paul's for a full Thanksgiving Mass. Quote, and forthwith was proclamation made through London that every man having any prisoner should bring forth the prisoner in his name by 9 o'clock upon Monday following. And enrich of them, so having prisoners or prisoners, should have his prisoner or prisoners restored, unquote. And so this is why I think the Londoners were involved in the fighting, as the king here is setting regulation for them to return with their prisoners for their due rewards. Quote, after this, divers are said prisoners sold, some for 14 pence and some for more, unquote. Yep, it was quite profitable joining the king on that expedition. However, many of the rebels had died on the field. And from them, well, Lord Audley was executed, and Flammock and Joseph were both killed. The Londoners would have witnessed the scene. Quote, that said Smith and Flammock were drawneth from the tower through the city and to Tyburn, and there hanged till they were dead, and after stricken down, and headed, and after quartered. And the same day was the Lord Audley had from the tower to Westminster, the Axe Tower borne before him, there in the Whitehall, arrayed and adjudged, and after that none drawn from Westminster into Newgate, and there he remained all night. And upon Wednesday in the morning, about 9 o'clock, drawn from the said jail of Newgate unto the Tower Hill, with a coat of armour upon him of paper, all to torn, let off, and there his head strike is off. Upon his soul and all else Christian, God have mercy, amen. And after his head, set upon the bridge, unquote. How grim. Later we read, quote, and upon the Saturday next following was the three heads set upon London Bridge, and the quarters of the aforenamed Flammock were set upon the gates of the city of London, as it to the west, Ludgate, Newgate, Cripplegate, and Alchurchgate, unquote. Quite apart from these gory, exemplary deaths, the king proceeded to fine all those involved in the rebellion with systemic and unprecedented severity. The fines were so severe they probably played a part in the second attempt at a Cornish rebellion later in the same year. This one never got as far as London, and it had a very different cause, because the second rebellion was risen in support of the pretender Perkin Warbeck. In the latest, and as it proved, his last attempt to repeat Henry Tudor's success in invading the kingdom, with the invasion of England from Scotland now in ruins and the young Scottish king desiring peace with England, Warbeck was dismissed from the Scottish court. He fled south by boat. He appeared at Cork on the 26th of July, but finding that Irish support was now no longer forthcoming after Poyning's time in Ireland, he set sail with 2 small ships and a pinnock and 100 or so men to land at Whitesand Bay near Land's End on September the 7th, in the hope that in Cornwall, the only region now in England which might be expected to show hostility to Henry the 7th, he might gain substantial aid. And he kind of did. He was proclaimed King Richard IV in Bodmin. But within a fortnight, all was over. He tried and failed to capture the city of Exeter, and by the time his forces had reached Taunton, his nerve failed him and he was arrested and taken to London. This invasion of Cornwall seems like pure opportunism. After all, he'd heard about the disturbances in the West Country and the attack upon London. But please note, he did not arrive until 11 weeks after that defeat on Blackheath. Yet still, the anger towards the regime of Henry VII was so great that initially, Perkin Warbeck did manage to raise at least 6,000 men to besiege Exeter. But still, now he was captured. In custody, Warbeck made a full confession as to his real name and his origins. He was the son of a boatman from France. And he soon wrote to his real mother, giving an account of all his adventures and begging her for some cash. And he was now at the king's mercy. Henry VII could by now afford to be generous to his humiliated and no doubt, well, charming captive. Besides, Warbeck was not a subject of his, and it might have been difficult at this stage to pin a charge of treason upon him. No restraint was put upon the young man, and he was treated as a member of the court. But there were no more wanderings and adventures, or so Henry VII thought. He was wrong. During the night of the 9th of June 1498, the date of Trinity Sunday, Perkin Warbeck climbed through an unlocked window in Westminster Palace, shimmied down the wall, fled the palace compound, got onto a boat and was rowed upstream to the Charterhouse at Sheen, where he banged upon the door demanding to be given sanctuary. Early the next morning, the yeoman of the guard, Henry's beefeaters, turned up to take him happily into custody. What the hell possessed him to try and escape? Well, according to a rather gossipy letter from the Venetian ambassador at Henry VII court, the reason was simple and plain and close at hand. He'd been encouraged to escape by two of the men in charge of watching him, who were tired of doing the job. Turns out that Warbeck's living quarters had been in a wardrobe of robes, which housed the king's clothes and personal belongings, and which was sited directly below the privy chamber. His jailers were two of the king's privy servants, William Smith and James Braybrooke, and they seem to have encouraged him to leap out the window with promises of help. Maybe that happened. We don't actually know. We only know for sure that after this, London witnessed the terrible fate of Perkin Warbeck. He was recaptured and now suffered harsher treatment. He was publicly pilloried in London, cruelly mocked and sneered at by the Londoners before he was moved into a windowless cell in the Tower of London. Here the king's men went to work on him, torturing his body and beating his handsome face. The Spanish ambassador to England, who saw him towards the end, said he was, quote, much altered, unquote, and that his injuries were so apparently savage, quote, that I and all other persons here believe his life will be very short, unquote. And yet, London was living with a paranoid king, and the land still had some who believed in the Yorkist cause. Warbeck was proof it did. And don't forget, the actual last legitimate Yorkist claimant to the throne, Edward the Earl of Warwick, was being held by Henry VII in the Tower of London. And then another pretender emerged in early 1499. This happened up the road in Cambridge. A young university student named Ralph Wilford was groomed by a local priest to believe that he too was the Earl of Warwick. And then he experienced a series of dream visions in which he was anointed King of England. Now, there's nothing wrong with having some weird dreams that say you've been anointed the King of England. The problem comes about when you start announcing this to the world. That turns the ravings of a delusional kid into, well, treason. And this is the paranoid regime of Henry VII. Saying such things was deadly, and Wilford's story now also ended up in London. Condemned, he was dragged to the city and through it, and then hung. His body was left on a gibbet on the Old Kent Road, the main southeastern approach to London, so that all travellers could see. But the Wilford incident, and also, I think, the long-running nature of Perkin Warbeck's conspiracy impacted upon the king profoundly. While he was trying to portray himself as his calm, wise, imperious king, he was clearly racked with paranoia and fear. At least one historian has suggested that it appears that he seemed to age 20 years in 2 weeks. He began to seek out medical cures for unspecific maladies, and he began paying for astrological prognostications about his future. Of course, he was also paying good money for his intelligence services to discover and deal with threats. The problem Henry VII was to discover, as his later Tudor successors also discovered, was that there was a flaw in paying for intelligence the way he did. If you create a system where when people get paid for discovering plots against the king, and those people need cash, then the incentive would be for them to help start or encourage plots against the king in order to get paid. Now, gens provocateurs were not a specialist thing. They would become the default status of any such intelligence system and its agents. And indeed, that's what seemed to have happened over 1499 in the aftermath of the Wilford incident down in London. Around the middle of the year, royal agents began to pick up on whispers of a rather fantastical plot, emerging in a sequence of meetings in secret houses across London. And it involved an apparent assortment of city merchants, opportunists, hangers-on looking for a chance to make money, and disturbingly, four of Warbeck and the Earl of Warwick's own wardens, who acted as go-betweens with the two men. The plot was supposed to see the conspirators seize the Tower of London, steal its treasure, blow up the magazine of explosive there, and smuggle Warbeck and the Earl of Warwick out of the country on a ship that just happened to be filled with a cargo of wool. The conspirators planned to move that summer when the city was quiet and the king and his household were on progress in the country. Warbeck seems like a zombie at this point, agreeing to anything said to him without much passion. And the Earl of Warwick, who'd spent the last 14 years in captivity, just seemed to be pleased with anyone paying any attention whatsoever. The two men were given pep talks in the tower and constantly prompted with encouraging news and, you know, the small detritus of conspiracy theories, secret tokens, a book of cipher, a file and a hammer for Warbeck to break his shackles. It's really hard to tell who were real conspirators and who were royal agents provocateurs, pushing and shaping this plot, incriminating the two prisoners, giving everybody enough rope to hang themselves. On the 25th of August, the net finally closed, and the fate of both men was sealed. It took a few months to sort out everything. On the 23rd of November in 1499, it was a Saturday, St. Clement's Day, the first day of winter, and that year, the autumn had been terrible with gales and storms. But regardless of the weather, Londoners came out in numbers to witness an execution. Lining our crowded and fetid streets, out through the suburbs of Holborn and west through the fields, they watched as a 25-year-old Perkin Warbeck bumped along behind a horse lashed to a wooden cart. When he got to Tyburn, surrounded by crowds and assembled dignitaries, he was hauled up a ladder to a scaffold. There, with a noose around his neck, he confessed. He said aloud he was not Edward IV's second son. In fact, he had no Yorkist blood in him at all. He was just a, quote, stranger, unquote, a foreigner, the son of a boatman from Tournai. He begged absolution of the king and, quote, all others he has offended, unquote. And he composed himself as best he could, a meek, pathetic figure. Then they whipped away the ladder and he jerked downwards. They watched his body convulse, then twitch as he slowly choked to death. And then it went limp as he died. 5 days after this, on the other side of the city, the ambassadors of the royal court were present at another execution. This one a private affair, as befitted a true nobleman. If Perkin Warbeck's trial had been kind of perfunctory, the Earl of Warwick's trial had an element of farce in it. He'd been summoned to a trial in London's Guildhall, but had appeared utterly confused by the proceedings, as he'd been by the plot to free him. Still, the Earl had been, quote, compelled to answer, unquote. There was something wrong with his trial. The records of it were locked away in a cupboard with three locks and the three keys being allocated separately to three unnamed royal officers. Regardless, under thunder and lightning was rain driving in off the North Sea and the Thames. The Earl of Warwick was led to his place of execution on Tower Green and there beheaded, the last true male claimant of the House of York. Henry VII had been on the throne for 15 years and 3 months, and only now, with these two executions, did he really feel safe. London witnessed all of this in, it seems, mute silence, and they commented upon it, but it's worth remembering there's other things happening in the city despite these things that was going to take up their time and attention. For example, in 1497, downriver from the city, on the evening of the 21st of December, Sheen Palace, where the royal family were settled for Christmas, was mostly destroyed by a sudden fire. The blaze had spread quickly through the old wooden building, with there being little time for the royal family to remove all their possessions, which we can say was proven by the mention in court records that afterwards the king spent £20 on, quote, rewards given to them that found the king's jewels at Sheen, unquote. Henry VII ordered the palace to be rebuilt in stone, and it's interesting to note that he renamed the palace after one of his many titles, the Earl of Richmond. What was to emerge from those smoking wooden husks was Richmond Palace. Back in London in the same year, the aging and weary London Bridge was showing severe signs of damage and disrepair. The drawbridge mechanism was showing especial signs of breaking, and the city authorities ruled that it should never be raised anymore except for defensive purposes. Still, not all was falling apart. The following year, Tudor London saw improved water supply as the Holborn Conduit was completed. The London residents oversaw the construction of a new conduit, which arrived at what is today the junction of Snow Hill, Cock Lane and Smithfield, near St Paul's. This new water conduit was fed from either a spring or a tributary of the River Fleet, and it arrived at the top of today's Lamb's Conduit Street, which got its name from William Lamb, who rebuilt this system in 1577. Again, this conduit is proof that back in Elizabethan times, people really did drink the water. They just preferred the booze. And also that year, we read again that the popular spare prince, Prince Henry, now 7 years old, was back in London on the 30th of October that year. After the city had organised a considerable cleanup of the streets and the city authorities decided to drive out any vagabonds and those showing signs of too many pox marks, the prince was escorted through the city and was presented with a pair of gilt goblets. London rather liked this young Prince Hal. London had a soft spot for young Prince Hals, it seems. And yet, despite everything and despite the mayor standing with the king against the Cornish and also showing favour to the spare, not the heir, tensions remained between the city and the king over trade. On the 7th of July in 1497, the new tax on English cloth over in Flanders, the Andrew Guilder, which I mentioned and explained last chapter, was at last withdrawn from being imposed on English merchants in practicality, although in principle it could come back at any time. The merchants and adventurers were therefore able to go back to Antwerp to trade between August and October of 1497. Trade was back. And yet by September 1497, there were new problems for the attention of the new Mercer governor of the merchant adventurers, John Etwell, who'd succeeded the aging and sick John Pickering. John Pickering's last act on behalf of the merchant adventurers took place here in London on December 21st, 1497. Down in the Bull's Head on Cheapside, Pickering, that mercer and merchant adventurer who had nursed the adventurers for decades, handed over documents for delivery to Etwell concerning his recent negotiations concerning some new issues that had just come up. Pickering died soon after this, and his passing was an end of an era for the company. Now, the cause of all these new anxieties had been the rulers of all the nations involved in this cross-channel trade, none of whom knew the first thing about the practical difficulties in trade, and they all decided they had feelings about trade, and they wanted all the merchants to comply with their feelings about trade. The Archduke over in the Netherlands had proposed to Henry VII that there should be a continuous fair or cloth staple at Antwerp and Bergen op Zoom, with goods not sold at the former being transferred to the other. London's merchant adventurers called shenanigans at once. For them, this would be used as an excuse to levy tolls twice on their goods, and it would also remove their own bargaining chip between these two towns. If merchants in Antwerp, say, played hardball, they could nip across to Bergen op Zoom and vice versa. And it's probably why the Archduke wanted to bring this in, with his merchants wanting to close that loophole. And at the exact same time this was going on, and when Etwell took over, The adventurers were now reporting that Scottish ships of war were in the waters around Zealand, looking to help themselves to English cloth ships, so convoys would be needed. The impact of all of this meant that only one official ship and one small bark went to the Great Fairs over the winter of 1497 and 98. Talks and negotiations started again from November 1497 until January 1498, with the Archduke's representatives in England discussing the cloth tax yet again, and the proposed staple for cloth, amongst other matters, and the merchant adventurers who were pressurising the king to oppose this as they went against the treaty he had just signed with the Flemish only a few years earlier, and which we covered last chapter. Luckily, the Lord Chancellor and the king saw their point, and Henry sent a formal letter of protest to the Archduke over Christmas of 1497. Greater talks about trade began in Flanders, and Etwell had to pay for two representatives from London's merchant adventurers to attend. These 1498 talks at Bruges did not see any breakthrough. And right now, the system of collection of dues charged on English cloth and wool products, and when they were sold at Bergen or in Antwerp, was so complicated, with so many sureties and levies and provisions, that the merchant adventurers deputed Governor Etwell to find any practical solution with help from the Lords of Antwerp, the wardens of the Mercer's Company, who was the formal company that had control of the merchant adventurers, now stepped up. The loyal and all-powerful Mercers of London decided to tell everything that was going on to the Royal Council, but kept this state of confusion from the wider population of merchants of any trade. And why did they keep it a secret? Because they feared that the, quote, murmur and crime, unquote, which would inevitably result, would prejudice the talks and maybe cause more violence on London streets. And the situation did get worse. By July 1498, adventurous ships sailing to the Whitsun Fair in Antwerp had all been arrested in Zealand, and the governor had to go across to meet the Duke's council in Brussels to try and get them freed. This problem finally began to start sorting itself out with a new meeting in Calais in 1499. No merchant adventurer took part in the talks that produced a far more important treaty between Philip and Henry than the 1496 intercursus. This included a settlement of some of the practical problems facing the merchant adventurers and wool staplers. Adventurers rejoiced that cloth could pass freely to all of Philip's land, with the usual exception of Flanders, where they'd have to sell wholesale and not retail of their cloth. And most importantly, the Andrew Gilder was finally abolished. The new treaty also gave Henry VII something he particularly wanted. Margaret of York had to apologise for her share in support of Perkin Warbeck. This new treaty was proclaimed on the 18th of May. It was apparently only now that King Henry realised that the most effective means of making the rulers of the Low Countries ignore Yorkist pretenders was to loan them money. The level of his obsession is revealed by the colossal sum of about £250,000 he made available to Maximilian and his son and grandson Philip and Charles in the years following 1499. So where did this money come from? Well, some of the Mercer's company were about to become unwilling participants in the financial extractions of King Henry and his servant Edmund Dudley. And yet by 1499, another totally different invasion struck London. The plague was back. Plague was endemic in the city, though some years were more remarkable than others. In 1499, an outbreak began in the streets of London, and the familiar rituals of mass death and mass will-making began again. This nasty epidemic lasted from 1499 and into 1500, and it is reported that 20,000 people died in the months it afflicted the city. It was savage and it was brutal, and it was an all too common sight in London. It is said that this epidemic was so serious, this was why Henry VII had signed his treaty with Maximilian in Calais to flee the Black Death around him. And yet with this, we're in the year 1500, and we have entered the 16th century. And London was about to enter the most insane 100 years of its history since the 11th century. Nothing was going to end the century as it started, except, for sure, the family of Tudor would still be on the throne. And I'm going to leave it there. Thanks for listening. Hope you're okay. Hope you're all fine. Hope you're all good. Hope you all had a fantastic new year and holiday period. It's January. The weather sucks. A good time to make yourself a nice cup of coffee and listen to episodes of The Story of London. Or any other podcasts of your choice. I'm not telling you how to live your life. I'm just giving you some options. All right. Thanks for that. I'll be back next week. And I'll see you then. This is all hoping you're safe, well, and good. Bye.